Mind if I test your tech savvy? Do you know what an app is? Of course, if you've got an iPhone or something, you absolutely know that. Otherwise, you may not. They're applications, simply programs that let various web functions work on various kinds of mobile phones. And of course, the debut of Apple's iPad means software developers have one more mobile device to build games and other programs for. 3 years ago, apps barely existed, but since then, the industry has exploded, as NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
Let's begin with a number, 3 billion. That's roughly how many apps have been downloaded for Apple iPhones, iPods, and now iPads. Ear Hockey is one of Greg Anderson's favorite apps. The senior software analyst at the Seattle Times is both a consumer and a creator of apps for mobile devices.
You know, when Apple recognizes you, or when you get up in the morning and you see the number of downloads, I mean, it's like Christmas every day. You know, it's caffeine because people appreciate what you've done, so you want to do more.
It's a good thing Anderson believes that creating apps is fun, because while he makes money building apps at his day job, he hasn't made a penny as an independent developer. His new app, which converts Celsius temperatures into Fahrenheit, can be downloaded for free.
I think every developer will tell you you'll get probably 10 to 15 times more downloads if it's free than if it costs money.
Indeed, roughly 80% of all apps are free. Many of the rest, including the hockey game, cost just 99 cents. So how did a market which focuses on free and almost free apps grow into an industry with annual revenues of $5 to $6 billion? Analyst Chethan Sharma offers a one-word explanation: Apple.
Apple really changed the game in many ways. They made it very simple for developers to get their application to the App Store in front of the consumers.
And once it was easier, faster, and more lucrative to develop apps and sell them, more developers began to create them. The promise of a digital Swiss Army knife became a reality. But making money from apps is another story. Charles Golvin, a senior analyst at Forrester Research, says developers who sell millions of their apps, even for a tiny price, can turn a profit.
That could be someone as big as Electronic Arts, you know, the largest gaming publisher, and also could be two guys in a garage.
And the guys in the garage who are giving their app away for free may be hoping to eventually sell you a premium version or sell you something that goes with it. Developers typically get 70 cents of every dollar spent to download an app. Golvin says the platform provider, like Apple, gets the rest.
And then you also have a separate stream of revenue in the form of advertising.
Horsepower.
Developers get most of the advertising dollars, but companies that serve up ads, like this one for Range Rover, make money as well. Seattle-based Zumobi does both.
So this is our creative and design studio where our new app ideation happens.
Zumobi's co-founder is John Sangiovanni.
We have several apps coming out focused on the female demographic, parents. That audience is obviously very attractive to advertisers.
As one of the leading mobile app publishing networks, Zumobi often partners with big content providers like NBC and Motor Trend to create their apps and place ads to go with them. Company CEO Ken Wilner suggests that in the app industry, being big has some advantages.
As a publishing network, we can cross-promote aggressively all of our applications. For example, you've downloaded our Motor Trend app. We will also suggest our NASCAR app. Very, very big advantage. And frankly, the two guys in the garage, that's something they can't take advantage of.
And as the number of apps has exploded, it's become more difficult for small guys to get noticed. Recent studies suggest the app economy is growing rapidly and could top $20 billion, the amount Americans spend on children's clothes, in just a couple of years. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Biographer Kitty Kelly has published tell-alls about Jackie Onassis, Frank Sinatra, and both George Bushes. Today, her 524-page unauthorized biography of Oprah hits the shelves. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports.
Oprah Winfrey comes into American living rooms every weekday, and she's famous for getting the hard to get, like Elizabeth Edwards, who talked to Winfrey first about the affair her husband John had while he was running for president.
You asked your husband for just one gift when you got married. What was that?
I wanted him to be faithful to me.
Did you believe that this was the only time?
I did. Mm-hmm. I did. I believed.
Only time with her.
Only time with her.
But as much as Winfrey talks to other people, she's famous for not allowing people who know or work for her to talk about her. Her strict non-disclosure mandates are legendary. Winfrey no longer gives interviews that she can't control, and when asked for comment on Kitty Kelly's book, her spokeswoman, Lisa Halliday, gave NPR the same one-line response that has been given to everyone else who inquired. Oprah hasn't participated in or read Kitty Kelly's book, so she is unable to comment. Follow-up questions were ignored. So writer Kitty Kelly was faced with a considerable task when she decided to do an unauthorized biography of daytime television's Queen of Talk. Kelly said Winfrey was intriguing in part because she was such a huge challenge, a bigger challenge even than the members of a powerful political dynasty.
I didn't just jump into this project. I really wanted to do a full-dimensional biography, and Oprah Winfrey was the only life story I wanted to do after the Bushes.
Kelly says getting her publisher to sign on to the project wasn't easy. After all, beginning in 1996, the Oprah Winfrey Book Club had been a crucial shot in the arm for the publishing industry for more than a decade. An Oprah endorsement can sell millions of copies. And it's not just good for books. She stumped for Barack Obama in 2008 at the Iowa caucuses.
So much has been said about what my jumping into this arena does or does not bring to the table of politics. I really don't know.
Eventually, Kelly got a green light for the book, but Winfrey, like Kelly's other celebrity subjects, wouldn't agree to be interviewed. So if the subject herself isn't going to talk, how do you do it?
For this book, although I interviewed 850 people, and I did not personally interview Oprah Winfrey, the biggest source of information in the book and the best source of information was Oprah herself.
Kelly began gathering information from thousands of Winfrey's past public utterances.
I spent about a year assembling every interview the woman ever gave in the United States and the United Kingdom in the English language on radio, television, newspapers, and magazines.
She also got two of Winfrey's family members, her stepfather Vernon and her cousin Catherine Carr Esters, to speak, and had photos taken with them and included in the book as confirmation. Oprah, a biography, doesn't contain any explosive revelations, but it does flesh out many of the things Winfrey has mentioned about her past. The sexual abuse she said she endured as a child, a traumatic adolescent pregnancy, a heavy flirtation with drugs, and the nature of the relationship with best friend Gail King. Kelly did do a two-part interview with Matt Lauer on Monday and this morning on the Today Show, but David Drake, spokesman for her publisher, Crown Books, a division of Random House, says rumors that other media outlets have declined interviews are true. Drake won't name names, but reportedly ABC is one of them. ABC's parent company, Disney, is partnering with Winfrey in several of the new shows she'll present on the Oprah Winfrey Network.
If they're deciding the merits of a book's newsworthiness on the basis of whether or not it might offend one of their corporate partners, it's an abdication of the primacy of letting the news value dictate the news.
NPR's media correspondent, David Folkenflik, says that's a sign of how interconnected much of modern media has become. He says Winfrey's stature has made her untouchable in many parts of the broadcast media.
She is clearly a unparalleled influential voice in media, that presidential candidates, that Oscar candidates, that people who have a message they want to get out to the public are desperate to have the attention and the good graces of.
Random House is betting that readers will be braver than some media outlets have been. Their initial run of Kelly's Oprah book is 550,000 copies. Karen Grigsby-Bates, NPR News.
And you can read an excerpt of the Oprah biography at NPR.org. Today, some former top executives at Washington Mutual give testimony before Congress. When it went under in 2008, Washington Mutual was the largest failed bank in American history. A Senate investigation found that WAMU, as it was called, dumped vast amounts of toxic mortgage assets into the financial markets. NPR's Jim Zarroli joins us to talk about the case. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
How did Washington Mutual's system work?
Well, I think Washington Mutual was actually a really big player in the subprime mortgage market. It was one of the drivers of subprime mortgages. And the bank made the decision in the mid-2000s that this was a really profitable line of business to be in. And so it started offering subprime mortgages through a subsidiary, Long Beach Mortgage Corporation. And it really pushed its loan officers and employees to sell as many of these mortgages as they could. In fact, people got paid more. They got bonuses based on how many of these loans they sold. And even if a customer qualified for a regular mortgage, according to the subcommittee, customers were encouraged to take a subprime loan because the bank made more money off them. So it became a huge business for WaMu. The bank sold $77 billion worth of subprime loans between 2000 and 2007.
Well, what made them any worse than all the other people who were trading in bad mortgage assets?
Well, you could say that they weren't. Some of the same abuses have taken place in other banks, for sure. They were just one of the bigger ones. One of the interesting things here that's going to come out, I think, is that some of the information from the subcommittee suggests that the bank started seeing a lot of delinquencies really early on back in 2006, even before the market started to tank. A lot of these loans were what are called option arms. Now, that's also something that was offered by other banks, but you got a low teaser rate on your mortgage for a few years. After that, you could keep paying a very low rate for a while. Then at some point, the mortgage reset, you had to pay more, and a lot of people couldn't afford it, especially because there was a great deal of fraud, according to the subcommittee, in the mortgage applications that people filled out. There was an audit done in 2005. It looked at two of the top loan officers, and it said that 83% of the loans coming from one of them were fraudulent. And yet, even after this was pointed out, the loan officer was allowed to keep working at WaMu for 3 years.
Is the suggestion there that the top executives knew that this was going terribly wrong and did nothing about it?
Yeah, I think that's one of the key questions right now, because the subcommittee released parts of a whole bunch of emails yesterday. They really made clear that people at the bank were warning about fraud for a long time. In 2005, there was an audit that warned about an extensive level of loan fraud in the Southern California offices. And this was significant because it wasn't just the mortgage applicants that were hurt by that. WaMu was taking these mortgages and repackaging them as securities and selling them to investors. And so if there was a lot of fraud, it's the investors who were deceived.
Well, I want to just ask very quickly, we've just got a few seconds, sorry to interrupt, Jim, but because this bank was packaging these mortgages and selling them, dumping them on somebody else, how did it catch up with them? How did they go bankrupt?
Well, I think eventually the market turned, prices started to fall, the securities were worth less, and everything came crashing down around them. But we're going to hear more about that. We're going to hear from the former president, the former chief executive today, and they'll be asked about that.
And we'll be listening for your reporting on that. Jim, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Jim Zaroli reporting this morning from New York. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.